Okay, so now we're going to continue with the Book of Esther. And what I'd like to take up first is just part of the story itself. Because what happened was we were discussing how the king changed over the his whole. We mentioned that he was basically a anti-Torah and anti-Jew, but he saw that it was really for his own benefit to be friendly towards the Jews, and on the contrary, that their philosophy is one that would secure his kingdom. And I just want to clarify one thing. When I said last time that Jews on the whole are very loyal and good citizens, I wasn't speaking in terms of a poll. I mean, what I was speaking about in terms of the Torah perspective. In other words, any person that keeps Torah must and is obligated to be a loyal citizen. So I was speaking in terms of the halachic person, it wasn't a matter of taking a poll. From what I observe, it is true, factually, but I just want to make that point. Okay, now let's take a look at what happened once Ahasuerus decided to join forces with Mordechai and to rid himself of the danger of Haman. So, what happened was that he said, and this is in the Book of Esther 8:8. Okay? Can you get me the Bible? Now it says, now he said to them as follows. He says, now you may write about the Jews what is good in your eyes, and the name of the king, and you can seal it with the ring of the king. And then he says, because a writing that was written in the name of the king and was sealed with the ring of the king cannot be returned. So, in other words, after he decided that he's going to make a Mordechai the prime minister, and after he killed Haman, so he realized the problem is that in a few months there's going to be a situation where the Jews are going to be attacked and destroyed. So here you find an interesting thing. He says that you can't, once something is written in the name of the king, it cannot be returned. Okay? So he can't, in other words, it can't be retracted. Cannot change his mind. Fine. I mean, in other words, apparently there was a discussion here, and obviously the first thing was to retract the edict to destroy the Jews. So the king said, I can't do that because once I sealed it, that's it. So the obvious question, of course, is what is he going to do now? So what if you send out another edict? You still have the same problem. You see, you have to understand what's the reason. Why is it that the king can't retract? Because, as we said, Ahasuerus was an intelligent man, and he realized that if a king changes his mind, it shows weakness. And therefore, the people are going to lose their faith and their respect for the king. So therefore, he says, it's impossible for me to rescind this original document that I sent. Okay, so what is he telling them to do? So he's saying, okay, so send another document. Isn't that going to look just as foolish? If you can't rescind the first one because you don't want to look like a fool, so obviously the second one, you're going to have a problem with the second one too. It'll look like a contradiction. So here again, the Scripture is asking you to look carefully and read between the lines. And there obviously was a situation here where the king said to Mordechai, look, this is my problem. He said, I can't rescind the past my past decree. So you work it out. You can write anything you want, but you can't make me look like a fool, and you can't make me look like I'm contradicting myself. So the question is, what really did Mordechai do, and what was he able to do, to accomplish? Okay, so I will give you an interpretation that the Ibn Ezra mentions, and then I'll give you my own interpretation, and you could choose whichever one you like. The Ibn Ezra says as follows. The Ibn Ezra says that what happened here was that the second decree made it clear that the king really never intended to kill the Jews, that his original decree was not to kill the Jews, but the but Haman is the one that that really instigated this whole thing, and he is not he is not what he is doing is he's saying that this was something that was done by Haman, not by me, and therefore, in, to prove it, he hung Haman and raised Mordechai to the position of prime minister. Okay, so that's one interpretation. And I would say my interpretation is along the same lines, but just a little bit different. So I would say that what Mordechai did was as follows. That Mordechai stated, he said as follows. He said that the truth of the matter is that what happened until now, really, the king favors the Jews. But this was all a ruse. This was all a plan on the part of the king. Because the king wanted to see who the anti-Semites were in his kingdom. And once they would be identified, then he wanted them to be destroyed. Now, some people have asked me, they said, really, when you take a look at the second document, what changed? Because all it says in the second document is that that the king, and that's in 8:11, it says that the king gave a right to the Jews to gather and to defend their lives and to destroy, utterly destroy, any nation or people that are oppressing them. And even to take the even to take their possessions. Okay, so the question somebody asked is fine. They could always defend themselves, and they could have defended themselves before. What good is this? They're going to have all these people attacking them, and they're going to be outnumbered, and they'll be killed. So for this, I think you have to understand a little bit of political psychology. And that is what the second decree was, is as follows. The second decree stated that really the king, on the contrary, recognizes that his Jewish subjects are really loyal to him. And the proof of the matter is that Mordechai is the prime minister. And this, the reason why he sent out the first decree was simply in order to bring out all those people that are anti-Semitic into the fore so that they should be able to be identified, and then the Jews will be allowed to attack those people. Because you can imagine that once that first edict was given, so various groups met, clubs met to determine how they're going to get together and how they're going to attack the Jews. Now, obviously, the ones that met and got together to do this were those people who were anti-Semitic to begin with. Like you find, like in Germany, all the various groups, anti-Semitic groups that were formed. The same thing happened over there, that the first edict really brought out into the open people who are anti-Semitic, because once people feel they have the support of the government, they feel power and strength, and they feel that they're endorsed, and therefore they come out into the open. Now, the second decree was that this was all basically a ruse on the part of the king. What he wanted to do was, he wanted to see who the anti-Semites were, they should stand up and identify themselves, and now what he's going to do is he's going to allow the Jews to destroy those people. So, the reason why they couldn't defend themselves is because of the psychological factor, that people on the whole, if they're anti-Semitic and if they feel the government is against anti-Semitism, they're fearful, and they're afraid to stand up, they're afraid to identify themselves, and they really refrain from doing much damage. Now, once they have the endorsement of the government, then they feel strength and power. The pogroms in Europe, the pogroms were like in a semi-halfway margin. What would happen would be where the police would withdraw, and the government wouldn't openly endorse it, but they would just withdraw, and people just felt that, well, the government really doesn't care, and we can go and attack the Jews. Over here, they felt secure that the government is on their side. Now, once the second edict came out, the second decree, these same people became extremely frightened. They saw, on the contrary, that the government really is against us, that the government really is in favor of supporting the Jews and recognize them as loyal subjects. So therefore, once that happened, they became completely filled with fear, and they were really unable to fight or to defend themselves. Fighting and defending oneself is 90% psychology. In other words, when a person feels courageous and he feels he has the endorsement and the backing, then he feels he can fight. But once he feels the whole government is against them, this is all a trick in order to get them into the open, to identify them, and now they're allowing the Jews to destroy them, there wasn't much fight left in these people. They recognize that basically their case is lost and they're doomed. So that, in my opinion, that is what the second decree did. Mordechai obviously had to spend quite a bit of time to figure out what to do. But the king, that's why the king said to him, he says, you write about the Jews, whatever you want, whatever is good in your eyes. He said, look, I can't work it out. This is the situation. I made this past decree, you can write anything you want in a new decree. But I can't rescind. You can't make me look like a fool and make me just retract it. So you work it out, whatever you want, whatever you wish to do. And Mordechai did work it out. What he did was, he said that this was all a ruse, just to really identify the anti-Semites, and the proof is that Haman, who was the leader of them, was hung to demonstrate that the king's position in this matter. And therefore, now all those people who identified themselves and revealed their true inclinations, now the king says they expose themselves, and the Jews have a right to destroy them. Once that happened, they were unable to fight, because you can't really fight unless you feel you have the backing of the government. Once you know the government is against you, and it just was a trick to destroy you, They lost their moot and they were unable to defend themselves. Okay, that's basically the way I understand the you know what happened here in this part of this juncture in the Book of Esther. Now I would like to go back to something else in Esther, because now we're up to the fourth personality, which we didn't take yet. That fourth personality is Mordechai. Okay. There is one thing which is a great mystery in the Megillah, and that is that Esther, from the very moment that she was called to be among those who were the candidates for to become queen, the Megillah, the Book of Esther, makes it quite clear that she remained anonymous. She refused to identify herself. Okay? And you'll take a look at 2:10. Okay? Esther did not tell of her nation or of her birthplace, because Mordechai commanded her that she should not tell. And then again, you find... You find again where in 2:20 it says Esther did not reveal her birthright and her nation, just as Mordechai commanded her, and the words of Mordechai Esther kept, okay, just as when she was raised by him, okay, she was under his tutelage. Now, the question is, why was it necessary to repeat this again in 2:20? And over here, it's even strengthened that she did reveal when she followed Mordechai, who was her mentor. So Rashi says, Rashi comments and he says that Mordechai, this means to say that Mordechai was constantly telling her not to reveal her identity. Okay, now the question is a big mystery. Why didn't she reveal who she was? What was the importance of keeping this secret? Okay. There are, again, several reasons given. One reason is that she really came from royalty, because she came from the house of Saul, and that if she would have revealed her identity, she would have been taken immediately, and she really didn't wish to become queen. The only problem with that one is the problem with that interpretation is that you see in 2:17, after she became queen, she still refused to reveal her identity. Now, if the reason why she didn't reveal her identity is because she didn't want to be taken as queen, then why did she refuse afterwards? I mean, there was no reason then. It's too late already. Okay? And another reason that's given is that this one the Ibn Ezra gives, he says the reason is because if she would have revealed who she was, then they would force her to violate the Torah law and make her eat things that are non-kosher. And that's why she wanted to remain anonymous, so that she could secretly just eat what she wishes, and no one's going to really notice what she's eating and what she's not eating. Okay, that's a possibility. I have a different interpretation. My interpretation is that the rabbis tell us that why were the Jews at that time, in that generation, condemned to die? Because the fact that they were saved was a miraculous event, but why were they condemned in the first place? God must have had a reason to condemn them. So the rabbis say because they joined in the feast of Ahasuerus, and they ate from his food, and that was a violation of the Torah. So, in my opinion, I think that here was something which Mordechai, as a leader, as a great leader of his people, he noticed this horrible event that the Jews are trying to curry favor in the eyes of the king, to the degree that they're willing even to violate the Torah and to eat from his feast. So he saw that the Jews were interested, very interested in that time, in politically gaining recognition and politically gaining acceptance from Ahasuerus and from the kingdom in general, to the point where they would violate their law. Now, he recognized that if everyone is going to know that Esther is a Jew, then this would bring a further decadence to this, into the situation. Because then Jews would really feel, hey, we've now, look at that, we have our queen. And therefore, that would lead them further along that path of trying to gain political power, and they would make further compromises and further concessions. As a matter of fact, they would feel, look, we're really being successful now politically. We gave in and we ate at the feast, and we're accepted as great citizens in this country, and now one of our own is a queen. We're doing great. Let's continue in this path. So in my opinion, that's why Mordechai commanded her not to reveal her identity, so no one knew, because the only ones that really knew her, she was from a group that kept the law of the Torah, small group, and the outsiders really didn't know, and that group just kept the secret. So no one really knew where she was, what her origin was. And this was Mordechai's idea. He felt that would be a disaster for the Jewish people if they would have a Jewish queen. And that's why I believe, even after she became queen, you see, Mordechai kept on, and that's what 2:20, if you look at 2:20, you see the emphasis placed on it. She didn't reveal, and she kept the word of Mordechai, because she was loyal, she was faithful to him as a mentor. So he as Rashi comments, and Rashi's correct, that he constantly necessary for him to keep vigilance and to constantly influence her not to reveal her identity. So apparently she was of the other opinion. She may have thought that maybe it's not such a terrible thing if the world knows and the Jewish people know that I'm a Jewess. Maybe that's a good thing. I'm already taken as a queen. She may not have wanted at first to be in that position because of the problems, the halachic problems it would cause. She didn't want that. And, of course, according to the Talmud, she was really married to Mordechai, and she didn't want to leave him. But she couldn't help with the decree. But afterwards, once she was already taken, she may have thought that, look, what is really so terrible? On the contrary, maybe this would be a good thing for the Jewish people. Maybe she'd be more influential as a queen. But Mordechai was of the opposite opinion. He felt that would be a disaster to reveal, and that's why that's why Scripture mentions that he constantly would exhort her and caution her not to reveal her identity. Okay, now let us go with that background. Let us go into the person the per- we go back to that crucial verse, which really is the one that is a revelation for the key to unlocking the ideas in the Megillah, is that verse that we mentioned at first, where it says that the analysis of what they saw and what they understood concerning these four players in the scene, and that is in chapter 9, verse 26. Okay, what they saw and what each one of these individuals, according to the way they acted, what their just reward was. And Mordechai was the one that refused to bow down, and of course in the end he became the prime minister. Now, why did Mordechai refuse to bow down? So we mentioned that there's nothing, no prohibition in the Torah to bow down to a person as a sign of respect. This we find in the Old Testament itself. But what it means is that Haman really, with his egomania, proclaimed himself to have supernatural powers. And once he did that, he was making himself into a god. And then to bow down to him would mean to acknowledge the fact that he has supernatural powers, which is basically idolatry. Now, Mordechai presented a completely different view. Mordechai showed the people that Mordechai, after all, you have to remember, was in the court of the king, a loyal subject, a man of great prominence. And it's very interesting, the rabbis say, for instance, in the beginning of the book, where it says that, in the beginning of the book of Esther, where it says about the great feast that King Ahasuerus made, and that is in Esther 1:8. So it says, to do, he says, and the drinking was not forced, because that's the way the king, that was the rule of the king, that to do according to the will of each person. Now, over here, you have the word ish va'ish, each man and each man. It could have just said lasos kirtzon kol ish. It could have said to do like the will of every man, but it says, it uses a different phrase, to do like the will of man and man. So the rabbis say that, again, this is one of the methods of Scripture to, through an extra little word, to give you an opportunity to analyze it. And the rabbis say that why was it written that way? Because really there were two important people in the mind of the king. And those two important people were Mordechai and Haman. At that time, there were the two most prominent people in the kingdom were Mordechai and Haman. And that's a reference to that in the fact that it says to do as the will of man and man, implying that there were two people in the back of the mind of Ahasuerus, that everything that he did was to impress these two people. And here we have, again, a beautiful piece of insight in psychology, and it's no doubt true, and that is that a person could make a great splash, he could make a great party for hundreds of people, but in the back of his mind, the whole thing could be, in the back of his mind, for one or two people that he wishes really to impress. And that's a matter of human psychology. And here, Scripture reveals, through its cryptic method, by just changing the phrase a little bit, that there were two people in the back of his mind, all these hundreds of people that were there all that time, but in the back of his mind there were really two people that were important to him in his life that he wanted to impress. And those two at that time were Haman and Mordechai. So you have to remember that Mordechai at that time was quite a prominent figure in the kingdom, and as was his adversary Haman. Now, when Haman was raised to this high position, and Mordechai refused to bow, this was something, of course, that was noticeable, observable by everybody. Now, why did he do this? Because he refused to violate the halacha. See, he went along as a loyal subject. All along, he was the one that saved Ahasuerus' life the moment he heard that people are plotting to kill him. But when it came to violation of halacha, that is the end of politics. So Mordechai was a great politician. He was prominent, and he was an intelligent, he exercised his intelligence in how to handle himself politically, but there was one restriction, and that is all politics ends when it comes to a violation of the law, of God's law. Then there's no more politics. That was the principle of that Mordechai lived by. Now it's interesting, and that is part of the lesson, and that's why it says, as I mentioned before, that when they analyze the in Esther in Esther 9:26, where it says that the that they analyze the what happened in the during the event, and this caused a whole new acceptance of the Torah, because they saw how what happened to each personality as they followed their own lifestyles. So here again, they saw the lifestyle of Mordechai in contrast to the lifestyle of the people at the beginning of the book, because Mordechai was an excellent politician, but the moment he saw there's a violation of Torah law, that was the end of politics. Then he acted in the most unpolitical way, in a way which was crazy, basically suicidal. But he had no choice. The people in the beginning of the Book of Esther at the feast, they acted politically correct when it came to even in spite of the fact that they violated the law of the Torah. So what the people saw in the end was that here they. This was really a major part of the lesson that they learned, that here they made concessions, and they gave up God's law in order to find favor politically in the eyes of this great king. What happened to them? A decree was passed that they should be destroyed. Mordechai, on the other hand, who gave up all politicking and refused to make any concession when it came to God's law, he is raised to the position of the most important position in the land under the king. So they saw that when man acts with reason, and the Torah commands a person to act with reason, as we said last week, Esther was a schemer. She used her intelligence and her mind to bring about a favorable result for the Jewish people, for our people. And Mordechai used his intelligence. And we believe in knowledge, and we believe in using knowledge. But there comes a point when knowledge dictates that we don't use any more knowledge and we simply stop. And that is when it comes to the violation of God's law. Then we refuse to continue using our minds or in scheming or doing anything else. That's the end of it. So what the lesson that was learned by the people from the personality of Mordechai and the way he lived his life is that it's just the contrary, that man thinks when he acts in a way that is politically correct that this is going to secure him his future. In a sense, yes, that is right. The Torah does not deny that. And here's where the Torah stands in contrast to other religions, which simply go to extremes. They just go from one side of one emotional swing to the other emotional swing. The Torah follows the rational swing, and that is that when it's permissible and it's rational to be political and to use every means at your disposal, then you are commanded, you're instructed, you should do that. But when it comes to a violation which would mean endangers your whole philosophical system, then you must stop and even give your life. And if you do that, then that is the most political thing at that time. If you act in that way, that's when divine providence will certainly bring about the best result that is possible for man. And that.
All right, Gary, you'll have to come over here.
No, come over here and you put you on there. This is Mr. Gary Buchanan.
Okay.
Rabbi, how do we know that the people learned the lesson of that Mordechai set an example of?
Okay. We know that the people learned a lesson because if you look at, again, 9:26, the end of that verse states what they saw and what happened to them. And that means that they analyzed what they saw in the whole story, and all the events that took place in the Megillah, and what happened to each one of these personalities. And then the next verse says that the Jews fulfilled and accepted upon themselves and upon their children and upon all those who are related to them. That means the all those the proselytes, the converts. So the and to make these days, and the rabbis say again that the Megillah, as I said before, was written in a way that that you can deduce. Again, from the formula of the words, you can deduce ideas from the way it's written. And over here, in the first two words, the first word is that they that they fulfilled, and the second word is that they accepted upon themselves. Now, the word fulfilled doesn't really belong there. You see, you really should say they accepted upon themselves to keep these days. The reason why it says fulfilled is because in the Torah, we have what it means is that they fulfilled what they... When we say... There's a phrase used for the acceptance of the Torah, and that is Kabbalah Torah. It means to accept the Torah. So the oral interpretation explains that that's why the word fulfilled is used, because it means to imply that they fulfilled what they already accepted somewhere else, which was at Sinai. So it means that this event, after they did that analysis in 926, then it says... They saw the insight. Their insight was great. They saw the truth, and they accepted and fulfilled. And the Talmud says that this was a period in Jewish history where the Jews accepted the entire Torah all over again, just like it came down from Sinai. And that is why this book, as I said before, is according to our Talmudic scholars, it's the one book that even after the coming of the Messiah will always remain, because it is the book that shows man the proper way to relate to Torah, and that is through analysis of what happens when a person keeps the Torah, what happens when a person does not keep the Torah, and the whole philosophy of life is really, the Torah life is expressed in this one book of Esther. So this one book of Esther will always remain holy, even after the Messianic era, when the five books of Moses will be the only ones outside the book of Esther that will retain their sanctity. And that is based upon these two verses. Because that word in Hebrew, kimu v'kiblu, which means they accepted, they fulfilled and they received, is also an allusion. The way it's written, it should have just said they accepted upon themselves. But that extra word placed before is an allusion to the fact that they reaccepted the entire Torah that they received years ago at Sinai. And this time they accepted it willingly because they saw that this is the true way of life. The gates of the king. Now, the gates of the king always means advisors. That's used in scripture many times. It's used in the book of Ruth, and it's used in the end of Proverbs. The gates. That's a constant phrase. Whenever you see the gates of the king, gates always means advisors, because the gates is where the advisors would sit next to the advisors to the king. So when it says Mordechai was a man who was in the gates, it means he was an advisor, prominence. That's what it means. Now I'd like to take up, which I think is really probably the most crucial point of the whole Megillah. And the Megillah really is a depiction of something that was written in the Bible many years before. And that is in the second book of the Torah, the book of Exodus. Because Haman, as you know, is the one that represented Amalek. And Amalek is the nation that the Torah commands us to utterly destroy. So in this book, we have in Haman, we have the philosophy of Amalek. And in Mordechai, we have the philosophy of Torah. Again, that's why this book is really so crucial. Now, what I'd like to do is just explain a little bit the difference between the two. And it's a takeoff on the verse in Exodus 17:16. Okay? where it says that, and he said that a hand is on the throne of God, and there is, it is a battle for God against Amalek from generation to generation. And what it means is that it means to say that the throne of God, it's as if there is a hand which is taking away from God's throne, and that is the hand of Amalek, and there is an eternal battle between God and between Amalek. Now, when the Torah says, it's an eternal battle, it means that this is a serious thing. Just an ordinary fool can't be in a battle with God. So it means that there is...
Rabbi.
Yes.
Give your translation of that again.
Okay.
And let me read our translation. All right, and he said, because the Lord, and this is a tetragrammaton here, had sworn that the Lord, there's the tetragrammaton again, will have war with Amalek from generation to generation.
Okay.
Now, that's not the way you read it.
Hold on a second. I'm sorry, Rashi translates it your way. So
You gave a literal translation.
Right.
Now, I've done a little work on that one.
Right, okay.
And I translated it kind of like this. Because there is a hand on the throne of the Tetragrammaton,
yeah,
will make war against Amalek from the generation of a generation.
Okay.
Now, how does that work?
Say it again.
Okay. Because there is a hand on the throne of God, will make war against Amalek from the generation of a generation.
You mean the hand is the hand of Amalek?
No. That's what I'm saying. This is back to what you and I don't want to get...
Okay, yeah, go ahead. You're saying what?
Get too far off of this. But it says that there is a hand on the throne of God. In other words, God has an anointed one on his throne that will make war against Amalek in a given generation, or from, or one in every generation.
Okay, yes. That Nachmanides gives that interpretation.
All right, so I did well then on mine.
You did well on that, yes.
Okay, all right. Okay,
you're right. No, you're correct. I'm glad you pointed it out. Your Rashi says the hand, I'm sorry, the hand is, it means God is swearing. And the lacking in the throne is because the word is stated, instead of the word throne should be kisei, and instead it says case, okay? Which case means that a part of the last letter is omitted in the word throne. The word throne has three letters, and here the one letter is omitted. So that is why it shows that the throne is lacking. Not as I said before, but on the contrary, he's saying that the hand represents a swear, that God swears, and Nachmanides says that it means to say that when there will be a king in Israel that sits on the throne, that that's like your interpretation, that he will be the one that actually does battle with Amalek. Okay? So, at any rate, but the meaning is that there is an eternal war between God and Amalek. Now, the question, of course, is what is this eternal battle? And as I said before, the adversary, if this is such a serious battle, it can't just be any fool that is fighting with God. I mean, it must be something which is really a threat. It's threatening. It's serious. It's not just the person that just negates God or any person who's ignorant of God. That's not a serious battle. A battle means, whenever you have a battle, it always means that there is a common ground. You can't have a battle if there's no meeting, okay? There has to be some meeting point. So obviously, what the Torah is teaching us, and the Book of Esther, which elaborates on that point, is that there is some kind of a meeting point, some kind of a common denominator between Amalek and between the philosophy of Torah, where there is a common ground, and yet they are still so diverse that they're at odds and that they're constantly battling with each other. Okay, now this is not, as I said, not a simple matter. What is this scene over here that is being depicted by Exodus 17:16 and by the Book of Esther? Okay, I believe that the point is, if you take a look at the Haman, the head of the Amalek, the head of the philosophy of Amalek, you'll find an interesting thing. You see, Haman's philosophy was not really, as we said before, hedonistic. The hedonist is not really at war with God. The hedonist is one who lives a life of depravity. He lives the life of an animal, not the life of a human being. The Amalek is a person that lives a life where he employs reason and he employs ideas. Haman was a person that employed universal principles, as we saw when we studied the Book of Esther. He employed ideas. When he saw that Mordechai didn't bow down to him, he started to investigate. Just a minute, what is this? What's the cause? Oh, it's a whole philosophy that we're encountering here. A philosophy? Well, we have to use ideas to destroy a philosophy. And his idea was to take that philosophy, distort it, present it to the king, start a campaign, and destroy the people. So he was a propagandist, but he worked carefully, meticulously with ideas. He wasn't just a person like a playboy. He wasn't just an instinctual person. Ahasuerus was more of a hedonist, but essentially a hedonist. But Haman was a person who worked with ideas. He worked with concepts. He believed in using reason. So what is the difference then between a Haman who uses reason and a Mordechai who uses reason? They both seem to employ reason. You see, and a similar thing with Hitler. Hitler was a person that was really a man of ideas. He used ideas. He wasn't really a hedonist. As a matter of fact, he was very self-sacrificing. When his troops didn't have meat, he wouldn't eat meat. When he identified with them, he abstained. And he was a person that believed in ideas. The difference is one thing, that the ideas of the Amalek, of the Amaleki, of a Hitler or a Haman, are really just used. The world of ideas is just being used for one purpose, and that is for the instinctual satisfaction of self-glorification. That is the reason that all the ideas are being used. But there is a recognition of the value of ideas, and the truth of the matter is that a person that doesn't recognize ideas is not a dangerous person at all. It is not even a person to deal with, because they obviously can't do anything. The world of ideas is the only place that a person can do something. Now, here we have a situation that you have two people that recognize the world of ideas. You have Haman and you have Mordechai. But there is a tremendous difference. Haman's recognition of the world of ideas is that ideas are to be used. They have a utilitarian value. What is their utilitarian value? They're to be used in order to gain the end goal of instinctual satisfaction through the glorification of the self. That is really that's the philosophy of Amalek. Same philosophy as the Nazis and Hitler, the super race. The idea of Mordechai is, on the contrary, that the world of ideas is really the world of holiness and sanctity. It's the world in which God reveals himself to man, and which makes man feel not great, but very, very small. And it is something which is to be used in order to reach God insofar as man is capable of. Over here, the world of ideas is really the end goal in itself. And according to Torah, to take ideas and to use them, or to use the human mind as a means and a vehicle of instinctual self-gratification, is to take the thing which God gave man, his greatest gift, and to use this thing to degrade it to the point where it becomes used for the lowest possible laudable animalistic purpose. That is why the Torah says that that is the battle between God and Amalek. The battle is because they both use the same thing. In other words, there is, even in Amalek, there is a recognition of ideas. But the purpose of the ideas is completely distorted. It means that the human mind was created so that man can use it for his own instinctual gratification. That is the battle. That's where the Torah says that is the most horrible thing that man can do, to take God's greatest gift and to subject it and subordinate it to a low animalistic purpose. The world of ideas is something which is to be used completely for its own sake, for recognition of the wondrous wisdom that God expresses in the universe and the Torah, for the appreciation of God's wisdom, for the recognition of how little man is capable of achieving and perceiving in that world of ideas. I think of what Albert Einstein said. He says that after a long life of science, he saw how little man can uncover from nature and with how much effort it takes to do it. A lifetime can be spent for one simple idea, one discovery, and that is a lifetime of people, of a man of the highest caliber of human intelligence and with the greatest effort. So that, on the contrary, the Torah recognizes the beauty of ideas for its own sake, and on the contrary, it is not permissible to take that, to use that world for your own personal instinctual gratification. That is the war. That is the battle. They both recognize ideas, but two diverse purposes. And I think this is something which people often, because they don't understand this concept in the Megillah, they make a mistake. They say that knowledge is no good, because look at Nazi Germany. They had plenty of knowledge there. And this is the point. Knowledge is good, and it's the greatest gift, provided it is used for the purpose and for the recognition of knowledge itself, that is the greatest beauty that God permitted man to partake of. And through that, he can appreciate God's wisdom and ultimately find his true place in the universe. But knowledge which is used, when the mind is used as a vehicle of the instinct, that is when it's a horrible thing. That's why it says that God's throne is lacking. His throne is lacking is because the throne is the knowledge. But the knowledge is lacking, Maimonides explains it, the throne is knowledge. But the knowledge is lacking as long as people look at knowledge as a vehicle of the instinctual. The throne of God will be complete when man recognizes that his mind was given to him to appreciate God, not to use it as a vehicle for his own instinct. And this is the difference between, that is why Mordechai uses knowledge and wisdom, and yet when he comes to a certain point, he stops. Why does he stop? Why didn't he keep on going with his knowledge and with his political acumen? The reason is because he realized his political acumen is really there just in order to be able to use it so that he can secure a situation for himself and for his people, that they could study Torah, that they could be involved in knowledge. That's the purpose of it. But once it comes to breaking the Torah, then you're denying the whole knowledge itself. So what good is everything? Then everything is worthless. So that's why when it came to breaking the law, when it came to break the law means to really show that knowledge isn't a value in itself. If God's knowledge is a value in itself, then that is the ultimate value, then you can't do anything anymore. You can only use your political skills in order to bring about a situation where you can partake of knowledge. But once you break the law, that means that your whole value system is gone. So we, B'nai Israel and B'nai Noach, value God's knowledge that he gave us for the knowledge per se. Now, we recognize that as the ultimate reality, the source of which is God, who is the reality behind all realities. That is the difference in philosophy, and that is the battle. That's why there is an eternal battle. Now, of course, this expresses itself in a philosophically, as we've just mentioned, but the Torah really believes in the opinion that your philosophy always has practical results as well. You know, philosophy is not just abstract. Philosophy is something which affects a person's life. Unless a person chooses to live a dichotomized life, which is an unfortunate one, where he's not in line with his with his convictions. But true knowledge demands that a person live in line with that. And again, we see this expressed in the two personalities, the personality of Haman and the personality of Mordechai. Haman's wisdom, his knowledge was used for one purpose, in order to have self-glorification. What stopped him? What was it that didn't let him live? It was one man that reflected a system of philosophy, which he recognizes. He was sharp. He recognized that philosophy is diametrically opposed to his whole way of life. And that these people will never recognize another human being. They look at self-glorification as a low kind of a thing. In other words, he recognized that they look at me as basically a lowlifer, an individual that's degrading his mind because he's an egomaniac. He couldn't tolerate that. That was intolerable to him to have such people. And that's why when he saw that Mordechai didn't move, didn't get up, and more than that, didn't budge the Megillah states, getting up is one thing, but he didn't budge. He was simply undaunted, unaffected by Haman, by the person of Haman. Then he was filled with wrath, filled with anger. He is the man who uses knowledge for self-glorification must have support from other people. His whole system is dependent upon other people. If he doesn't have other people, he is gone. Haman alone can't exist because he can't have self-glorification without anybody else around. He must have the support of others. In contrast to this, and that's why the person, the evil man, is really a person who is never at rest. The scripture says the evil are as turbulent as the sea. It means their life is a constant life of turbulence because the inner world, they can never find any inner peace because they're trying to create a fantasy, an illusion. They sense it's an illusion, and the only way they could give themselves solace is by having other people join in that illusion. That gives them a momentary solace. But basically, underneath, there is always that turbulence. Hitler could not sleep at night. He had to have people surrounding him all night long, all hours of the night. Underneath, in his psyche, was constantly restless. He always had to have that constant support that people think he's great. He had to have people around him at all times. That is the man, that is the personification of the Haman and the philosophy of the Amalek. In contradistinction to this, the man of Torah ideas, is the one that is in line with reality. He recognizes his position in the universe, and he is happy with his knowledge. He doesn't need anybody. He could be all alone, and he could be at peace, because he's at peace with reality. So this is depicted very beautifully with the case of Mordechai. Because if you remember, when Mordechai was given all that honor from the king, suddenly he was taken away from his sackcloth, and he was ordered by the king to ride on the horse and to be taken out in the middle of the streets and to be given all this high honor. So he went. Of course, he went. And then it says right after that, just give me a moment over here. It's in 6, 11, and 12. Okay? And it says that Haman took the garments and the horse, and he dressed Mordechai, and he rode him in the midst of the city, and he called out before him, "So shall be said to the man that the king finds favorable in his eyes, the king desires." And then it says in verse 12, "And Mordechai returned to the gates of the king." And the rabbis tell us, what is the importance of saying that he returned? Who cares? Obviously, he's going to return home. Why do we care? Return to the gates of the king? So the rabbis say he returned to what he was doing before in the gates of the king. And if you remember, he was wearing the sackcloth. So he returned immediately to the sackcloth. That means that all this honor that was bestowed upon him, the greatest honor possible in that society, meant nothing to him. The moment it was, he went through the motions, Of course, the king ordered him to do so. That's the only intelligent thing, is to go through the motions. But personally, in his inner world, was not changed one bit. The moment he left the moment they left him alone, he immediately returned to the gates of the king and re-put on the sackcloth and continued his mourning, continued his prayers, and continued to instill in the people the proper frame of mind so that God will have mercy and change the decree. So here we see the man of God's Torah that is completely unaffected by the external world, completely oblivious to what other people think about him. It is meaningless to him. Although I shouldn't use the word oblivious, because I don't mean to say that he doesn't take notice of what's going on. I don't mean to say he's unintelligent. On the contrary, as I mentioned before, he does notice and he does know and he does act intelligently. But inside it is worthless, because any person, any human being that is in the presence of God, truly in the presence of God, cannot be affected by what another human being thinks of him. It's absurd. As a matter of fact, if a person is affected by what other human beings, insofar as a person is affected by what other people think of him, whether positively or negatively, this is a direct barometer of how much he is in God's presence. Because if man is in God's presence, and he knows that in God's eyes his life has value, what importance could it mean if another human being, or many human beings, either praise him, or else they act disparagingly towards him? It should be absolutely zero, absolutely meaningless. But the reason why people are affected by others is because they aren't on the level where they are truly in God's presence. And insofar as they are not, they are affected by what other human beings think about them. But the great Mordechai returned immediately to his sackcloth. This was all the honor, didn't mean anything to him. So the man of Torah, the man who is in God's presence, his life is completely different than the man of Amalek, as represented by Haman. It's a different kind of a philosophy, and it's a different kind of a existence.
We got 1 minute.
Okay. We're just about there.
Okay. All right. That's okay. Good. I would like to go back and compare that text in Exodus with Haman and Amalek in relation to Aaron and Hur holding the hands up of Moses.
Yes.
And then we translated that verse, said that there is a hand on the throne of God.
Right.
And see, Moses is sitting on that rock,
right,
which is symbolic of a throne.
Right.
So I think that would be an interesting discussion in relation to this, doing the comparison between Haman, Mordecai, and this whole situation there.
That's good. That's a good point.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Okay.
And you going to be in tomorrow morning?
Yes, I will.
All right, I'll give you a call.